for accommodating me over this video system. I hope this gives you a useful talk. We will see how it goes. So, again, this is a talk about holography and unitarity in gravitational physics. So, like many talks at your conference, it's about gravitational information. And at risk of repeating things from previous talks you've already had, if you can go on to slide 2 here, I thought I'd start with just a lightning summary of an interesting set of questions about gravitational information, often called the information paradox for black holes. So I have on the screen the standard conformal diagram for an evaporating black hole. And somehow there's been a lot of discussion about this diagram recently, so I wanted to just review it so we're all focused on what I think are the important issues here. Let me start with this large question mark that I've drawn in the upper left-hand corner. So I'm going to take the point of view that I'm going to talk about gravity without assuming any particular non-perturbative theory of quantum gravity. So things in the upper left-hand corner that are in particular above the red line I've drawn, the red line is supposed to indicate the place in the space-time where the physics becomes strongly coupled and the curvature becomes strong. So everything above that line, I claim that I have no real knowledge of what happens, since I'm going to try to stick to some low-energy description of the physics. Now, the point I want to emphasize is that, of course, if physics behaves like we normally think it does, what happens up in that question mark region does not impact at all some of the most important questions of gravitational information. I think that something we all talk about a lot is the fact that there are many suggestions that in black hole evaporation, information that comes in with the collapsing matter. So in my diagram, there's a shaded orange triangle of collapsing matter, and there's a green arrow indicating that we believe we can follow information that comes in with the collapsing matter, whether it's books, hard drives, et cetera, as it goes deep into the black hole region. That's all down here below. The red line that indicates the cutoff on the physics we can describe with low energy. So the point is that there are many suggestions in gravitational physics from static mech analogies, from string theory, from EDS, CFT, that information that comes in along the green arrow is somehow transferred to the outgoing Hawking radiation. And the point that I just want to remind everyone of is the Hawking radiation is created in this region that I've marked with a green blob and red arrows coming out. It's the region which is outside the would-be horizon of the black hole, and it's the region which is in particular below a diagonal blue line I've drawn. That diagonal blue line is the last null ray below the strongly coupling region. So we would expect that all the physics below that blue line we can describe using some low-energy description, using, if you like, theory of quantum field theory in curved space-time or perturbative gravity. And so the question is, is it indeed true that information is somehow transferred to that upward Hawking radiation? And if so, how can it happen? And again, I want to emphasize that if physics satisfies the usual kind of locality and causality that we expect, there's no way that any modification of the conformal diagram up in the question mark region could possibly impact the Hawking radiation, which lies down below my blue line. Okay. So I wanted to emphasize those facts in reviewing standard issues about black hole evaporation. So, of course, there are many people in the audience there that I'm sure believe that information is transferred to the Hawking radiation. And many of you may feel that, well, the only way this can happen is if there's some new, deeply non-perturbative piece of physics that changes our notions of locality and or causality, that would somehow cause information to be transferred in a space-like way, or somehow make that question mark region of the diagram relevant, or some such thing. So I would like to try to sell you today on an alternative picture, so if we can advance to the next slide. I'm going to try to sell you on the idea that there's a sense in which this information which falls into the black hole that we can see moving along this green arrow is somehow also stored outside the black hole in a place where it's sort of ready to be picked up by the Hawking radiation. And I'll explain what I mean more by information being stored outside the black hole later. I should mention that the important point of this is that I want to claim that at least some equivalent version of the information is stored outside. And I'd like to claim that this is possible using physics that we actually know and understand, things that are basically just the physics of classical gravity or general relativity. I guess I said quantum mechanics here on the screen, but there's a sense in which even quantum mechanics is not really that important what I have to say. The thing I want to emphasize is that I'm going to claim that there's no need for particularly stringy effects or new non-perturbative non-locality that we would not have expected from the theory of classical gravity. So I'll try to sell you on this point of view during my talk.
Before you go ahead, are you going to be telling us that there are two copies?
No.
Okay.
Let me get to the next slide and say something about this. Okay. But I am, of course, well aware of the no quantum Xerox theorems, and what I want to say is completely consistent with them.
Okay.
The main features of classical gravity that I'm going to focus on are gauge invariance and the gravitational constraints. Let me remind you the nature of the gravitational constraints. The gravitational constraints, and in particular the gravitational Gauss's law, of course, are responsible for the fact that we know black holes don't swallow all the information. In particular, information of the black hole energy, or mass, is available outside because you can measure it using the gravitational Gauss's law. That's an example, that's a particular case that we're familiar with, where one piece of information, the energy of the black hole, is in a certain sense available in two different regions of the space-time. You could either look at all the matter that fell into the black hole and count up what fell in, or you could stand off at infinity and use Gauss's law to measure the energy. And the point is that, if you like, at the quantum level, there are two operators. One is the sort of Gauss law flux operator at infinity. The other is something that's a complicated description of the stretch when you come into the black hole, which are just equal by an operator equation of motion, namely the gravitational constraints. And I want to claim that something very much like that is responsible for, as I say, encoding equivalent information outside the black hole, as well as letting it follow. So that's a case where, if you like, in a certain quantum information theory language, I'm not going to claim that there are two separate qubits, two independent degrees of freedom, that happen to encode the same information. There's no copying of information from one to the other. I'm going to claim that there's one qubit, which happens to have two operators which can access it, and those two operators are things like the total stress energy that fell in, and like the gravitational Gauss law flux at infinity, that just happen to be equal by the constraints.
But John, is it really true you can look inside the black hole and know what the total mass of the black hole is? I would have thought you really could only look at infinity and know that, or if you like, the whole hypersurface.
So let me not address that technical question with Raphael right now. Let me just set this up as a kind of motivation. Let me give my talk, and we'll see if you're happy with the final result. Okay? All right. So I wanted to mention just a little bit of this. In order to try to say something definite and concrete, I'm going to work in particular settings that have boundaries and certain boundary conditions. I want to talk about asymptotically flat space, as I draw on this diagram, but I'm actually going to spend most of the talk talking about asymptotically anti-de Sitter spaces, which are a little bit cleaner. And the point of concentrating on these cases with boundaries, which are perhaps not the most generic situation we're interested in, is that they have to be very clean, and they allow me to take one main fact from classical general relativity and make some interesting argument about information and gravity. And that one clean fact is that in these cases, asymptotically flat, asymptotically anti-de Sitter, etc., we know that there is a real notion of time evolution generated by a Hamiltonian. But the Hamiltonian has a special property, which is that, at least on shell, when the equations of motion hold, it is just a pure boundary term, something which can be sensed at infinity, since we're using the gravitational Gauss system. So I wanted to briefly mention that this talk can be thought of as a kind of enhanced version of a proposal that I made a couple years ago with Vijay Balasubramanian and Moshe Rosali about using measurements of energy at infinity to extract information out of the interior of systems. In that case, we were concentrating on measuring the energy eigenvalues, and in a case where the Hamiltonian is non-degenerate, there's a lot of information there. The difficult part of our previous story was measuring, if you like, the phases of energy eigenstates. We had previously suggested you might be able to extract information about those phases by measuring commutators of various operators with a Hamiltonian. So without redoing that story in detail, let me just say that what I'm doing here is to focus on precisely such, not just the Hamiltonian itself, but also commutators of other asymptotic fields with a Hamiltonian. In other words, I'm going to discuss what you might call the algebra of asymptotic observables for the system, and I would like to try to argue that those observables contain a complete set of information. So this was all just kind of introduction. If we can go on to the next slide,
If you had extra matter fields, would the total Hamiltonian still be a boundary term?
Absolutely. So if I'm speaking, of course, about some non-determinate theory of gravity, then I am just making a conjecture, but it's a natural conjecture. In the context of classical gravity coupled to matter fields, then it really follows from the way that Diffie-Hellman invariance works in the theory that no matter what matter fields you add in, the Hamiltonian is some boundary term. Now, depending on the boundary conditions and the matter fields, the details of that boundary term can change. There are cases where that boundary term is not just a gravitational boundary term. The matter fields can appear in the boundary term as well under certain boundary conditions. But it's a very general property that is always just some boundary term. And Samir, in the context of like ADS space, you actually know this very well from your thinking about ADS CMT. In that context, you know that no matter what boundary conditions you impose, the Hamiltonian is always given by an integral of the boundary stress tensor over the boundary. And that really is a result in classical GR.
Okay.
So let me give you a little outline which lists the specific claims I want to make during this talk. Okay? And this talk kind of has two parts. One part is a series of technical statements about algebras of observables, which, at least if I make them in classical gravity, I think that they are, there's nothing to debate, they're just true. And then the rest of the talk is about how to interpret these statements. So I have certain claims written on the board here. I want to start off talking about a property that I find in the anti-de-Sitter context that I like to call boundary unitarity. And as I'm going to review in the anti-de-Sitter context, it's natural to talk about an algebra of boundary observables. And this algebra has enough locality that you can talk about looking at a given time on the boundary, say t1 or t2, and talking about the algebra of boundary observables at each time independently. So I want to just point out that it's a property of classical gravity that if you look at two of these algebras of boundary observables at two different times, those algebras are in fact equal. Every operator in one can be written as a function of the other. Actually, let me say a bit about what I mean by equality of algebras. So I will sometimes mix my, I will apologize for this, but I may go back and forth in kind of a classical language and a kind of a quantum language. Everything that I want to say can be said at the classical level, at least as far as the technical statements go. At that level, it's a statement about algebra, about Poisson algebras. So I'm talking about the algebra at the classical level, but I'm talking about the algebra generated by observables at one time. I mean the algebra obtained not only by multiplication and addition, but also taking Poisson brackets. Of course, at the quantum level, that's just the natural algebra of observables you would construct. So the claim is that in the anti-de-Sitter case, it's a natural consequence of, say, classical gravity, that these algebra boundary observables at two times are equal. I will then claim that in the quantum context, that means that there is a strong sense in which information which is encoded in boundary observables at one time, or information which is present on the boundary at any one time, is also naturally present at any other time, just by properties, familiar properties of gravity. You might then ask if these boundary observables I'm going to discuss are a complete set of observables for the theory. In a context like ADS-CFT, you might expect the answer is yes, but I don't want to assume ADS-CFT. I want to work in a bulk gravity theory. And in that context, I don't have any definite claim I can make that the algebra of boundary observables is truly complete. But I can argue that it's complete in a certain context, which is that if I restrict myself to doing perturbation theory, not solving the full non-perturbative gravitational equations, but looking at perturbation theory, I will claim that the algebra of all perturbative observables everywhere in the bulk space-time is in fact equal to the algebraic boundary observables, say, at one particular time t. That's the second claim I'm going to make. And I think that claim deserves the name anti-de-Sitter perturbative holography. It says that in some sense, at the level of perturbation theory, complete information is available on the boundary at any one time.
Don, can I just interrupt one second?
Yeah. Sure, Mr. Mirror. Please go ahead.
I'm just wondering, if you take any quantum field theory, nothing to do with gravity, and if you were to do a path integral over all the lattice sites which are inside the boundary, you get an effective Lagrangian or operators for the boundary. And if I'm not going to actually put physical sources inside, all my data is now in terms of boundary variables. Is it, this is more than that, or this is like that?
This is more than that. So there are two things to say here. If you imagine doing, say, a scalar field theory in the Sitter space, and doing an integral over the things inside, okay?
Right.
Then certainly you would have some effective description that just now involves integrating with the boundary observables.
Right.
But that effective theory would not have any kind of locality or unitarity about it. The boundary in a scalar field theory, if I look at the boundary observables at some one time, okay, they don't encode all the information. There is extra information deep in the bulk, which would be necessary if I tried to evolve the theory forward to a different time. Okay?
Right.
So the non-trivial part of this claim, the place where gravity comes in, is actually the statement that the algebra perturbative observables is equal to the algebra boundary observables at one single time. Okay? Alright. If I allow the algebra boundary observables for all time, then indeed, as I'll discuss later, the statement will be true for scalar field theory. But what gravity allows me to do is to sort of pull all that down to one time. Okay, and that's really what I think holography is about. Holography is the notion of holography is the idea that complete information is available on the boundary at any particular time. You don't have to wait for it to come out.
Don, is that a claim that you're going to show, or is it an assumption you're starting with, or what's the statement?
I will show this. I will show the statement written on the board. The algebra of all perturbative observables is equal to the algebra of boundary observables at any one time.
Okay.
Okay.
Equal means isomorphic?
Equal means equal. It means you can use the, it means in particular that you can use the constraints and the equations of motion of the system to take anything that you would have written as a perturbative observable in the ball and to rewrite it as some algebraic combination of these boundary observables.
At one time.
At one time, yes. Possibly through a certain limiting procedure. I should really probably talk about this as the closure of two algebras. But that's a technical point. Okay. So I'll try to talk about the ADS part in detail because it's actually very simple. For lack of time, I won't say as much about the asymptotically flat part, but I wanted to at least write my claim in the asymptotically flat case here for you so you can see it, and I will repeat it later in the talk. In the asymptotically flat context, I don't have a clean statement analogous to the ADS boundary unitarity, but at this perturbative level, there is a statement that I can make. And the claim I make in the asymptotically flat part is that the algebra of all perturbative observables, again, allowing all times to bulk and so forth, is equal to the algebra of, if you like, boundary observables associated with space-like infinity, little I zero, and a kind of early piece of Sry plus. So by early piece, I mean choose some cut of Sry plus, if you like, choose some advanced time u0, and consider the past infinite piece of Sry plus below that cut. Then I want to claim that those observables, just in that past infinite piece of Sry plus, and the ones in space like infinity, are in fact a complete set of observables perturbative. So that's the claim I want to make there, and I want to take a few minutes, if I have time, to talk about the implications for black hole evaporation for the kind of questions that I asked, that I was alluding to a few minutes ago.
Maybe you're going to cover this, but when you say perturbative, does that mean linearized, or does it mean all orders in perturbation theory, or?
It strictly means choose some order in perturbation theory, which is not the linearized order, but any order beyond that, and to fix that order and consider the algebra on both sides of that order of perturbation theory. So it's all orders except the linearized one. They say that it's certainly not true in the linearized theory. It requires, it basically is true at any level where the Hamiltonian constraint is non-trivial, and we can use the gravitational Gauss's law to rewrite the Hamiltonian as boundary.
Just to interrupt you once again on that, there's this usual thing in gravity where, because of the Hamiltonian constraint, the wave functionals are only a function of the three geometry, and you have the usual problem of time that they're not functions of the four geometry. Just given that, is that the same as saying that everything will collapse to one time is the same as the usual fact that the wave functionals are only functions of three geometries?
No. So that, I mean, there's a statement like your statement, the wave function is a function of three geometries, would be true in scalar field theories as well. And that's really, that's just the quantum equivalent of, at the classical level, solving the initial value problem, okay, and expressing things on one hypersurface. And so that's part of the story, but obviously what's interesting about these claims is that you can not just work on one hypersurface in the ball, but you can work on a hypersurface in the boundary. So really, there's more to this story.
There's a Hamiltonian, there's a non-zero Hamiltonian here, exactly. Because there is a boundary. Yeah. So it's the wave function has a real functional.
There's no problem with time here in any case. All right, so let me go on and jump into some of the details of at least this first ABS boundary unitarity piece. So let's go on to the next slide, slide six. Oh, I guess before doing so, I want to have a brief comment on the role of quantum mechanics. As I said in my outline, I can make all these claims about algebras at the level of classical mechanics. It's a statement about Poisson algebras. So I just wanted to say that while there is a technical statement about algebras that I claim is true at the classical level, I think the implications of this are very different at the classical and quantum levels. And that's because the algebra I'm talking about at the classical level would be, again, a Poisson algebra. So looking on the left side of the screen here, the claims I want to make are analogous to noting that for the angular momentum algebra, the z component of angular momentum, jz, lies in the algebra generated by jx and jy. It's a familiar statement. You take the Poisson bracket or the commutator jx and jy, you get jz. So at the classical level, well, that's true, but we don't usually think about that as having a lot to do with information. We certainly wouldn't claim at the classical level that information stored in jx and jy, the information stored in JZ is also stored in JX and JY. We certainly believe at the classical level that if we have a spinning top here in our laboratory and we measure its X component of angular momentum and its Y component of angular momentum, we can do this as many times as we like, we would have no information at all about the Z component. But quantum mechanically, things are a little bit different. Quantum mechanically, at least if we had an ensemble of identically prepared quantum tops, and we imagine making sequences of measurements, measuring jx and then jy, or for some of the elements in the ensemble, measuring jy and then jx, we actually can obtain information about the quantum commutators. And so by doing measurements of that kind in quantum mechanics, and perhaps doing appropriate interference experiments that I won't detail right now, one can actually imagine performing measurements of jx and jy and obtaining information about jz, just because jz is the commutator. So I just want to remind you of this distinction when it comes to interpreting these technical results in terms of information and form. All right, so let's go on to slide seven here. Great. Let me remind you a little bit about Andy DeSitter space. And for my purposes, I just want to talk about a theory of, say, Einstein-Hilbert gravity and Andy-Sitter boundary conditions. Maybe there are some scalar fields in the problem. We could add some Maxwell fields as well, but let's not worry about that, just to keep life simple. I need to define some boundary conditions, so there is, in fact, a non-trivial Hamiltonian, as we were saying. So, as many of you know, it's easiest to fix boundary conditions in Andy-Sitter space using a sort of Fefferman-Graham gauge, which is written up there on the screen. It's just a kind of conformally rescaled version of Gaussian normal coordinates coming in from the boundary. So the interesting part is to take this, so there's a z coordinate that you can think of as kind of the Gaussian normal coordinate coming in from the boundary, which I take z equals 0 on the boundary. And then there's the tangential part of the metric, which we call gij, which can be expanded in powers of z. So a natural kind of analog of Dirichlet boundary conditions for gravity, the kind of boundaries I like to consider, will be to fix this leading part of the metric, which is often called the metric on the boundary, Gij0. And if there are scalar fields in the problem, we can fix the Dirichlet data for those scalars on the boundary as well. Which by Dirichlet data, I mean just meaning the leading sort of slowly falling off piece of the scalar field in an analogous Deckard random space. So for simplicity, let me start by talking about the case where I happen to choose some stationary boundary conditions, so some metric Gij0 on the boundary which has a finite killing field, and where the scalars also respect that symmetry. Sorry, I'm getting a little noise in the background here. Curtis, can you close that for me?
Sure.
Okay. So let me just assume there's a time translation symmetry just for simplicity. What I want to remind you of is that in the Stefferman Graham expansion, there are typically two interesting pieces of data. There is, say, this Dirichlet data in the metric case Gij0 that I fix. And depending on the dimension, the next couple of terms are uniquely determined in terms of that Gij0 by the Einstein equations. But at some point, there's a new piece of data, which you might call the Neumann data. It's something in the gravitational case which is, can be thought of as the extrinsic curvature of the boundary, which is independent and not determined by Gij0. In ADF-CFT language, we usually call this extra piece of gravitational information the boundary stress tensor, Tij. In the context of a scalar field, there's an analogous new piece of information you can think of as the Neumann data for that scalar field that I'll just call phi n. And the property that I wanted to remind you of, for those of you that are ADS experts, and to mention to those of you who are not, is that these local, if you like, Neumann data for the gravitational and scalar fields in the boundary are really observables in the sense of bulk gravity. That is to say, that if you carefully think through with these boundary conditions, which diffeomorphisms act as gauge transformations on the system, then as usual in systems with boundaries, the diffeomorphisms that actually act non-trivially on the boundary, say that generate isometries of the boundary metric, are not gauge transformations, those are global symmetries. The ones that are gauge transformations have to fall off faster at the boundary. And if one thinks through the details, it turns out the diffeomorphisms that are gauge transformations act trivially on this Neumann data that I'll call the boundary stress tensor of the gravitational field and the Neumann data for the scalar field. So in the sense of bulk gravity, these fields on the boundary are really observables. I just wanted to emphasize that. Okay. The other important fact that I'll remind you of, So that allows us, to define this notion of the algebra of boundary observables at some time on the boundary. By that I mean just take some cut of the boundary or use some time coordinate, say look at the surface t equals 0 to be definite, and on that surface, on the boundary, we have a set of observables generated by the boundary stress tensor and the Neumann data of the scalar field, and that's what I mean by the algebra of boundary observables at some time t. It's that algebra in the classical case where you would generate the algebra with addition, multiplication, and Poisson brackets, and then perhaps taking some appropriate completion.
Don,
yes.
Is that algebra, it's not a commutative algebra? Because you only need the momentum.
No, it's certainly not a commutative algebra. I agree.
It's not commutative. That's the question, because...
It's not? No. I mean, as you say, it has both coordinates and momentum in it.
So you use G0 and T as your algebra, or you just use...
Well, G0 has been fixed as a boundary condition, so G0 is a C number.
So...
But this is for all time on the boundary. This is for the boundary as a 2 plus 1 dimensional surface.
So let me explain the notation. If I say algebra of boundary observables parenthesis T, I mean just take one time on the boundary, take, if you like, a two-dimensional sphere on the boundary, and consider the associated algebra of observables.
Okay. Now,
I could also talk about the algebra of boundary observables at all T, which would be your 2 plus 1 dimensional system.
Okay. Now, it's true that the G n for n 2 and greater is determined by the g0 and the g1, at least I think in 3 plus 1, if you know them for all time.
So for G1 and G, in the 3 plus 1 context, G1 and G2 are covered by G0, but G3 is not.
Oh, so it's G3.
G3 is independent data, which is basically what I call TIJ.
Right, but then G4 and higher are determined by G0, G1, G2, and G3 if you know them for all time. Then you know the G for higher for all time. But if you know them for one time, then the Einstein equations does not determine the higher G's for that time or any other time.
That is correct.
Okay. So you're not making a magical claim.
I certainly hope I'm not making any magical claims.
Okay.
Can I ask my question differently? Where is the Poisson bracket of TIJ with itself?
What is the Poisson bracket of TIJ with itself? Yes. Well, I don't know is the answer. That's something that one has to calculate.
You see, my confusion is that initially in gravity, it's the Poisson, I mean, TIJ, you know, what I mean, the momentum pi and g, you know, are conjugate variable. And then if I fix g, I'm only pi. So maybe it's a technical question. How do you get an induced non commutativity purely by looking only at f of the phase space variable?
This is really the full phase space variable. I mean, this, in terms of, if you think canonically, where you want to split things on a time, on a space-like surface, then, well, TIJ knows a lot. I'm not sure to say it. Again, this G0 is really fixed as a boundary condition. It's a C number. It doesn't contain any information. All the information is in TIJ. Let me just say a little bit more, which is that, in practice, it's often useful to thicken out T equals zero surface a little bit, and maybe I'd like to include in my algebra derivables at time t not just tij and phi evaluated at say t equals zero, but maybe I'd like to include their time derivatives as well. Okay, that might make you a little happier.
Okay, no, yeah, I was thinking in the bulk. I mean, maybe in the bulk t and g, whatever. You know, G and the momentum are conjugate variables.
Yes, yeah, so
you're claiming there's a well-defined, which is
very conjugate.
No, no, so the algebra now includes G3ij and G.3ij.
No, just G3ij.
No, he wants G.
No.
It doesn't make that much difference.
You're sure it does.
That is a derivative along the boundary, okay? So including G3 dot is just thickening out this algebra boundary derivatives a tiny amount around some constant time slice.
It's including another set of independent. If you're saying that your algebra also includes the time derivatives, that's a different statement.
Yes, it is a different statement.
Okay.
It is a different statement. I will explain in a moment why including the time derivatives doesn't matter.
But you think at the technical level, the exact Poisson algebra of the boundary is not yet defined.
I have not given you a closed form expression of that Poisson algebra. We can calculate it, say, perturbatively or around certain classical backgrounds, but I have not written down the exact algebra in an axiomatic fashion. I have not given you a set of generators and relations for the algebra. I've merely given you a set of generators.
Okay, last question. Right. Whether a black hole in the space-time the mass would appear in which order of G?
Excellent question. So let me explain that with the comment at the bottom here. I want to remind you that, so as you all know, the Hamiltonian in a system like this is going to be a pure boundary term. In fact, let me just summarize a certain bit of work, which is well known to the string theorists in the audience, which says that, in fact, the thing we usually think of as the ADM Hamiltonian for the system and a simple expression in terms of this object TIJ, which is basically, in the 3 plus 1 context, G3IJ. And the simple expression is written here on the screen. The Hamiltonian is simply an integral over any cut of the boundary, if you like, any hypersurface, any space-like hypersurface of the boundary, of this boundary stress tensor TIJ contracted with some time-like vector field C, which you can think of as the one generating D by DT, and a normal to that cut in the usual way. You integrate with respect to the natural area element on the back. So that answers your question, Lee. If there's a black hole in the center, its mass is encoded in the Hamiltonian, which is encoded in this TIJ, this boundary stress sensitive thing, which appears in the 3 plus 1 context in the third order Fechner-Rand coefficient. So that's where the dynamical information of the space-time comes. So, to be specific, we see by explicit construction that the Hamiltonian lives in this algebra of boundary observables I want to discuss at each time t. Okay. Hamiltonian in a stationary context is conserved, is the same operator each time, it lives in each observable algebra separate. And this is really why it doesn't matter if I add time derivatives by hand. Time derivatives are, of course, nothing other than commutators of some Tij dot is just the commutator of Tij with h, which clearly lies in this algebra observables at one time t.
So is your A of t the same as what's usually as what people call the asymptotic symmetry group, or it's something more general than that?
Oh, it's something very different. So let me just emphasize the difference. The asymptotic symmetry group would be the algebra of, well, symmetries of the boundary conditions. So in this case where I fix a boundary metric Gij0, the asymptotic symmetry group turns out to be the algebra of actually conformal symmetries of Gij0. So some finite dimensional algebra. The algebra boundary observables will contain objects like the Hamiltonian which generate asymptotic symmetries, but it also contains many more objects. It contains Tij of x, and this Moivre data for the scalar field evaluated at any single point x on that constant time surface. Those are objects that don't generate any asymptotic symmetries, which are much larger algebra observables. But it certainly does contain all of the asymptotic charges, which is an important starting point. All right, so let's go on to the next slide, slide 8, and we'll put together some of these observations. Again, so far these are just observations about classical gravity in anti-de-Sitter space. I've summarized them at the top of the screen. We have some Hamiltonian, which lies in the algebra of boundary observables at each time. It has this explicit expression in terms of this Tij asymptotic observable. And what does it mean that it's the Hamiltonian? It means that if you take any other observable for the system, whether that observable is a boundary observable, a block observable, or what, as long as that observable has some notion of being evaluated at some given time t, its time derivative is given by a commutator with the Hamiltonian. That's what a Hamiltonian does.
But you haven't shown that the commutators or the Poisson brackets close just within the t's. So it might be that the Poisson brackets map you into G17.
I certainly make no, so let me emphasize Lee's statement. I'm talking about an algebra generated by t's and phi's. I have not given you the relations in that algebra, and I'm certainly not even claiming that the commutator of two t's is another t. It may be some completely new operator. That's fine with me. Okay? Again, I'm not trying to give an axiomatic presentation of what the algebra is. I just want to say, you know, keep taking commutators until things finally close. See what kind of algebra you generate. And yes, it will be some very large algebra. Okay? My claim is going to be a statement about that very large algebra. And while I don't have a clean statement about how many things are generated by those commutators, this doesn't bother me so much physically because at the quantum level, I can always imagine, if you like, performing measurements of any operator in that algebra by just measuring t's over and over again in different orders.
Don, what about the rest of the Hamiltonian? The Hamiltonian is the boundary term plus the constraint, which is a bulk term. And you don't have the right evolution unless you also have the commutator with the bulk, the Poisson bracket with the bulk terms.
I can answer this in various ways. One is that, suppose I'm working at the classical level, if I work in a covariant phase-space formalism, then I work on shell and those constraints are just zero.
But the Poisson bracket, the constraints are zero, but the Poisson brackets with observables generate non-zero evolution.
No. Let me remind you the facts. So, in fact, if I was working in a covariant phase-space formalism, they would be zero at the operator level. They would be
classically.
Classically, classically, indeed. If you wanted to work in a more familiar canonical formalism, where we often say you need those constraints, then let me remind you that my statement about time evolution here is something about observables. And an observable, by definition, is something which commutes with all those constraints. So if you like, I could use a language where I define an object that I call H, which is just this boundary term. You might have an object you prefer, which is the boundary term plus various multiples of the constraints. But once I stick either of those expressions inside this commutator with an observable, I must get the same answer. So my boundary term does generate time translations when acting on observables. The bulk constraints just don't matter. This is why it's critical that these boundary fields I've been talking about are in fact observables in the sense that they are invariant under all the gauge transformations. If that were not true, I would have to worry about adding constraints and the interior contributions to the Hamiltonian. But for observables, there are no issues.
And so, Don, just to clarify, your assumption is basically that in the bulk, things are unitary, and therefore that in the boundary, it's going to be unitary. Is that because you're assuming that the time evolution of the operator is given by the commutator of the Hamiltonian?
Let me not mention the word unitary yet. We'll get there very soon, okay? But yes, I am assuming that time evolution of observables is given by the commutator with the Hamiltonian. Again, we could do this as a property which is simply true of classical gravity, and it's a property that I certainly expect to be true for any definition of a Hamiltonian
Good. Now, do you have an algorithm to actually compute even classically such observables? That is, such an observable starts off as a function of the T, then it's a function of anything else that the Poisson algebra closes on. And yes, your story is right. If I had an object in closed form that commuted with that Poisson had zero Poisson bracket with the constraints, then I could compute its evolution just with the boundary term, which is the Hamiltonian. But you don't have those forms of the observables.
I'm not sure I really understand the question. At the classical level, there is this Neumann data for boundary fields. We know they are observables. And at the classical level, you could compute this commutator via any way you like. I would tend to compute it as a timeless bracket, something which is naturally defined in a covariant way that involves perturbations of the equations of motion and Green's functions. And just at that level, it's just a matter of computing Green's. If you want to compute the commutator evaluated on any classical solution, it's just a matter of computing a Green's function, which is certainly a doable calculation.
Okay, done. One more question. You mentioned this probably, but how far do you want to go in this expansion, this Fefferman-Graham expansion, in order to define your boundary observables? So the normal derivatives into the ADS, how many?
So it depends on the dimension, but I just want to go to where that new piece of information will. I'm not going far enough to introduce the boundary stresses. And then you really stop.
Because if you would go arbitrarily far, then you actually would not really have local observables. You could start putting in a Laurent expansion or a Taylor expansion
I stop with this boundary stress test. That's as far as I
went. But just to reconfirm, exactly my question too. When you take multiple commutators of these T's, you're not actually secretly going deeper into the as a Taylor series into the bulk.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you are.
Oh, maybe you are, maybe you aren't. But I think I'm not sure to say about that. Certainly, the operation is defined on the boundary. Okay, it may in fact be equivalent to some story in bulk, and that will be fine. But my point is that it's something which is, it's an operation involving observables that live just on the boundary. What else to say?
Yeah, and these kind of things are somewhat important because, to some extent, again, AES CFT is almost a tautology, or at least this kind of dualities. Yeah. But the deep statements of these things are one, that the boundary theory satisfies the axioms of local quantum field theory, and secondly, that the bulk theory has some approximate locality and has some approximate description in terms of local gravity. Those are the two, at least if you go in one direction, the first one is the non-trivial one, if you go in the other direction, second statement is the non-trivial one.
That's right.
For example, with this real duality or whatever you want to call it, where you start with a local theory in ADS, sure, you can play your game and put everything on the boundary, but then your boundary theory would not satisfy mm-hmm. the axioms of a local quantum field theory. And vice versa, if you would start again with the local boundary theory, then it's very hard to actually prove, or at least that's the basic statement of the ADS-CFT duality, that the corresponding system that you can build on an ADS space, which is sort of a topological thing, but that there's an approximate locality in the book.
That's right.
But your statement, so that the statement that you would have to verify in your sign of the argumentation is that the boundary theory satisfies locality the way a local quantum field theory
Absolutely. And as you know, many of those aspects of locality are not hard to verify. They're just a simple calculation in the gravitational context. The fact that the TIJs, the boundary stress tensors, have local commutation relations, if their commutators vanish outside the light cone, is a property of the bulk gravity and the causal structure of ADS space.
But
that kind of calculation is great.
But it would still imply some kind of limit on how many operators you can put at a given point. It's not that you can make your algebra arbitrarily large. Algebra of observable. Because then you
There's certainly no problem with taking the stress tensor and taking arbitrary commutator tensors with itself.
All right, but that's translating things along the boundary.
Along the boundary.
But if I would start translating things into the bulk, then you don't.
But this is all I want to do. All I want to do is take the stress tensor and the corresponding data for any scalar fields or vector fields in the problem and take commutators and then look at myself.
That's fine. That's good.
That's all I want to do. So far, all I've been doing is reviewing simple properties of bulk gravity, and that's really all I'm going to do. We have this time evolution equation here on the screen. So let's just, for the moment, suppose that we can exponentiate the Hamiltonian the way we usually try to do in quantum mechanics to define an operator you would call e to the ih delta t. Well, then we can solve that equation, and it's trivial to express then any observable at time t2 in terms of the same observable at time t1 conjugated by e to the iht. And now we just observe that, the observable at time t1, so this might be tij at time t2 is equal to e to the minus ih delta t times tij at time t1 e to the ih delta t. So the observable at time t1, why is the observable algebra at time t1? True. The Hamiltonian, we already know that lies in the observable algebra at any time. So I can view the entire expression on the right-hand side of that equation as a combination of operators that lie in the observable algebra at time t1. And yet, of course, we've written any algebra, any operator at time t2, these boundary observables at time t2, in terms of the right-hand side. So we conclude immediately that if I can exponentiate the Hamiltonian, that the two algebras observables, the algebra of boundary observables at time t1 is equal to the algebra of boundary observables at time t2 in the desired sense. And this is a statement about information conservation, since we have a complete, since we are related to algebra observables, so I'd like to dignify this with the term boundary unitary. And it's just a consequence of the fact that, again, the Hamiltonian is itself a boundary term. And I claim that in the quantum context, I would interpret this equality of boundary observables as saying that any information which is present on the boundary, encoded in the algebra of boundary observables at time t1, just that one time, must in fact remain present on the boundary and is somehow accessible in terms of the algebra of boundary observables at any other time t2. So let me pause here and see if there are any questions. I will talk on the next slide about what's involved in this assumption that you can exponentiate the Hamiltonian, and I will then explain the asterisk next to my suppose. But leave aside such questions for the moment. Is there something else? Are there other questions from the audience? Because this is the basic point.
This would also be true if I just had two systems where they didn't interact, right? I mean, if I have two, it's not just a function that, I mean, if I have two systems, they don't interact, and I have a Hamiltonian, which is the Hamiltonian of a bulk plus the Hamiltonian of a boundary, and there's no interaction between the two, then total unitarity will also imply unitarity of the bulk degrees of freedom as well. Is that?
It certainly is true that a statement like this would be true if the bulk was not interacting with the boundary. Of course, we know that in this system, because we can solve the classical dynamics, at least approximately, say, at the linearized level, we know there is at least a sense in which the bulk degrees of freedom do interact with the boundary. If I start with, I think the linearized system of, say, gravity plus scalar, I put some initial data of compact support on a given space-like surface for the scalar field, it will eventually spread out and register on the boundary. Okay? So, in the way we usually think about this system, at least in terms of linearized dynamics, there is an interaction between bulk and boundary. At the full nonlinear level, it's a little harder to say what's going on, just because the nonlinear level, at the non-perturbative nonlinear level, we should talk about physics of observables. And aside from the boundary observables, it's hard to get one's hands on what one might mean by some other extra independent bulk observables. So we'll get back to talking about that later. But as I say, because of the perturbative level, we do see that there are interactions between bulk and boundary. I think that this statement is both interesting and non-trivial, that it does seem to imply that somehow the boundary observables do, in a sense, decouple from any other independent bulk observables that may or may not be present. Yes?
Any question to make things concrete? If I think in 2+1 dimension, am I really off-shell to imagine that this boundary algebra that you're talking about is generated by T is just the Virasoro algebra in pure gravity?
In 2+1 dimensions, you could call it just the Virasoro.
So that's
if you have just the TIJs, once you add additional scalar fields and so forth, then you have some extension. But sure.
So I can, okay, now you mentioned gravity, there would be an analogous there as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm trying to figure out what's being claimed and what's not being claimed in the form of, let me ask a question that I'll clarify that. So suppose I had some exact global solution of the Einstein equations with
yes.
these boundary conditions. And now suppose I could modify it on some initial, let's choose some initial value surface.
Yes.
Suppose I couldn't modify that solution somewhere on the surface, but where the modification was completely of compact support.
Okay, I was told this is true, yeah.
So then information about that modification wouldn't show up at infinity, and it wouldn't show up for a finite time, either to the past or to the future of that
Correct.
Slice of infinity. So that is not a problem for what, do you think that's true, first of all? I think that's true.
Yes, I think it's true. It's not contradicting this claim.
And it's not contradicting this claim. So you're not claiming that all information from the interior necessarily shows up on some particular slice at infinity.
Not at the level of classical physics anyway. Okay. And again, my point would be that in your solution, if you simply try to, if you like, measure these boundary observables at your initial time in the classical theory, well, I agree that measurements of the boundary observables initial time in the classical theory don't tell you about your deformation in the interior. But in the quantum theory, I think there's a sense in which they do. At least if we thicken this surface a little bit and allow ourselves to make repeated measurements of these boundary observables in different orders in an arbitrarily small neighborhood on our initial time surface. And that's because, I mean, let me say this in a heuristic way, but it's based on the board. One boundary observable that I can imagine measuring in the quantum context is the Hamiltonian. And another boundary observable might be this Pij or the value of phi. And if I should make measurements of those two objects in alternating orders and compare the results, I effectively generate some information about their commutator, which tells me the time evolution. And if I can really do this in such a way that is equivalent to exponentiating the Hamiltonian, I can find out of a finite time evolution. So the statement is that by such repeated kinds of commutator measurements, you should be able to tell that the signal you prepared in the interior that was originally a compact support will eventually spread out and hit the boundary.
I'm not trying to understand that, because the stuff that is at infinity is usually the conserved stuff, so charge, Hamiltonian, etc., energy, and that, and I mean, that's going to be different, that you expect to be hugely degenerate, because at every moment it's, you know, the universe is, I should be able to have a whole bunch of time slices where, you know, with a charge.
I want to repeat an earlier comment, which is that in the AES context, this algebra of boundary observables is much, much larger than the algebra of asymptotic charge. It is not just the manifestly conserved information. I'm not quite sure. Let me, if you're not familiar with AES space, I can best explain it by saying that anti-de-Sitter space behaves very much like doing gravity or some field theory in a finite box. And you're very familiar with the fact that in a finite box, all kinds of information can register itself in, say, the Neumann data on the boundary of that box, which is not just the conserved charge.
Does it make it clear if you explain it in this Virasoro algebra context? So you say algebra is just Virasoro algebra, yeah? So suppose you take that as an example, for instance.
I don't know if that makes it clearer or not.
Concerned. Yeah, they are concerned, but Virasoro generators. So it seems
louder.
Do you have the word generators are company? Okay, wait.
Well, Laurent is saying that in 2 plus 1, you said that the algebra of observables is the Virasoro algebra. Yes?
The algebra of the TIJs can be thought of as the Virasoro algebra, yes.
On the other hand, he wants to think of those as giving him conserved charge, all of them giving him conserved charges. So isn't there a tension between the two?
It is not. It's
not
it
is.
Just true that in 2 plus 1, there are a lot more conserved charges than there are in higher dimensions. But if I have a couple of scalar fields in the problem, then in 2 plus 1 dimensions, I have the algebra that they generate at infinity as well, which is something that's going to give me additional operators beyond the Virasoro algebra. And as far as I know, those scalar observables cannot be thought of as conserved quantities.
Yeah, I think Lee's comment was that the pure gravity theory is topological.
Right, so that's why it's done true in the scalar fields, which is the right thing to do. Right? Then,
yeah,
then
there's very little interesting information in the pure gravity theory.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Don, one final comment here. What you were just saying about operators.
Yes.
quantum operators are anyway not that local, right? For example, if I take the Feynman propagator between what you thought of were local operators is non-zero outside the light code. So is a little bit of that what is happening in here? That once you go to quantum operators, what looks like local commuting things, operators when they act on states are not as local as you might think. As for example, what you see from the Feynman propagator being non-zero outside the light code.
So my short answer to that is no, I don't think that's what's going on here. It's certainly true that states in quantum mechanics have non-local correlations and that's manifested in the non-vanishing of the Feynman propagator outside the light cone. But I haven't talked about states at all in this discussion. I'm really talking about the algebra of observables. And, you know, in, say, scalar quantum field theory on a fixed space-time background, the algebra observables really does have a local structure, commutators that exactly vanish outside the light.
But still, this guy managed to pick up the information of this localized state that was just being discussed, right? You put a state right inside the interior, not leaking towards the boundary at all, but by taking multiple commutators at the boundary, you managed to reach that state. I was just wondering, does that mean just because operators are inherently non-local, that you can reach beyond where you thought you could reach?
So let me explain what I think is going on here, okay? Which is a kind of non-locality, but not quite the one you mentioned. So what I've been talking about are observables on the boundary, and I like them because they really are observables. They're gauge invariant, even in the context of diffeomorphism invariants. So I know what they are. It would be interesting to ask if, in Raphael's context of the scalar plus gravity theory, is there some other observable, which is somehow a bulk observable, a gauge invariant quantity, that would capture the information about his deformation? You might interpret this result as saying that, well, at least at some level, any such bulk observable must also be a boundary observable, that perhaps there aren't any independent bulk observables with that information. Certainly, this is saying that if there was, I think it's saying, maybe I should think about technicalities here, but I think it's saying that if there was a bulk, something that you would dignify with the term bulk observable, which captured Raphael's deformation, that somehow that observable would not commute with the boundary observables, even though you might have thought that a bulk observable should be localized in one place, boundary observable should be localized at space-like separation, and you might have expected some commutation. So for me, I think there is a story about non-locality of observables here, but I think that the source of that non-locality is diffeomorphism invariance. We know that there, that at least at some rough level, there's no such thing as a local bulk diffeomorphism invariant operator. Okay. So I think that it's that diffeomorphism invariance, and again, the associated gravitational constraints that intrinsically relay information in the bulk information in the boundary, which is responsible for this problem. Certainly, that's all I've used in the argument. I've used the fact that the Hamiltonian is a boundary term, which is really just a consequence of diffeomorphism invariance and gravitation.
So they're just two different species of particles out of which you could have made Raphael's localized wave function. Which of those it is, you could actually pick up because of a long commutation of the species measuring operator with the with outside, just because of diffeomorphisms.
That's the idea, I believe. Yes.
Okay. Tom, let me just ask you a technical classical relativity question, because I know these. I used to know the answer to these. To this question.
Okay.
If I look at this expansion in from the boundary of asymptotic VADS, at what order would I see gravitational radiation? Is gravitational radiation in the third order? So in the T's, this is the T
present. Yeah, gravitational radiation will imprint itself in this Tij quantum. In a different language, this Tij is essentially the pullback of the electric part of the biotensor to the boundary.
Okay.
That's
okay.
A piece of information we normally think of as encoding gravitational radiation.
Okay, so this piece knows about what could, quote, be seen looking down the fast light cone from that cut of the boundary.
Yes. Absolutely. So someone should tell me how much more time I have and when I should stop. I seem to have had a lot of questions, and time is certainly passing. When should I wrap up here? Should I have any more minutes?
No, I was actually, the chair is a very light chair this morning. I was going to say that I'm going to cut you off in half an hour, because we have to feed people, but
right.
People seem to be enjoying themselves, so I don't want to put a stop to the festivities.
That's great. I don't want to keep you through lunch, but I will press on for a bit. Okay. So let me pass on to the next slide, slide 9. I want to talk a little bit about this assumption that the Hamiltonian can be exponentiated, and what does that mean? And I want to start by talking about that at the level of classical physics. The level of classical physics, what it really means is that I can define the operation on phase space, which is flow by a finite amount delta t along the Hamiltonian vector field generated by the Hamiltonian. Now, that's in a certain sense the statement that the equations of motion can be solved for a finite time evolution. There is some long time existence result for the equations of motion, and that it can be understood as a symplectomorphism on phase space. Now, what I want to emphasize here is that we know that in classical GR, usually you form singularity after finite time, and you can't really evolve equations of motion for a long time, at least not throughout the entire spacetime. But what I want to emphasize is that the argument I've given only involving these boundary fields, these operators that live on the boundary. So, in fact, I only need this notion of flowing an operator along the Hamiltonian vector field by a finite parameter in phase space to be well defined for the boundary average, the boundary fields. Or, in other words, I only need to be able to solve the classical equations of motion near the boundary of the spacetime. So, the assumption that I can do that, I would argue, is a kind of cosmic censorship assumption for the classical systems. it's okay for this argument to cross a level if the singularity forms in the interior of a black hole, as long as it doesn't forbid me from evolving the system along the way. So at the classical level, I would argue that the assumption that I could exponentiate the Hamiltonian is essentially a cosmic censorship kind of assumption that we often make when proving interesting results in classical. At the quantum level, was there a question?
It's also a uniqueness argument that there's only one unique solution to the equations of motion. Because otherwise I could add in kind of probabilistic terms or whatever to the...
Absolutely. I'm happy to sweep all that together under a new kind of anti-de-Sitter cosmic censorship hypothesis. I want to remind you that in the Assiniboine-Black case, where people are taking care to formulate cosmic censorship precisely, they typically phrase it as the assumption that global hyperbolicity is maintained in the region to the past is fly. Okay? So it's again a statement that the evolution exists, it is unique, in a region near the band. So something equivalent would be sufficient for my purposes. So at the quantum level,
Can I go back to the classical, are there some kinds of restrictions on the TIJ? I mean, I know that I can write down naked singularities in ADS space, and they give me some TIJs, but somehow you want to dismiss those, right?
I do. I mean, the classical level, I would want to start with a phase space formed from smooth initial data, so at least one hypersurface where the data is smooth to rule those
throughout
out.
Throughout the whole bulk. Smooth throughout the whole bulk.
Smooth throughout the whole thing. And I agree with you that I don't a priori know exactly what set of restrictions that places on the TIJ. I'm certainly not trying to claim that I can specify the TIJ arbitrarily. I'm merely saying that if we work with the space of bulk solutions and then probe it with these boundary observables, we can obtain these interesting results. So the philosophy is certainly that I want to define the system as a bulk system and, as you say, insist that solutions are smooth on some space-like surface somewhere in. All right, so what kind of assumption am I making at the quantum level if I assume that, again, we can exponentiate the Hamiltonian in its useful form? Well, I'm either making a quantum assumption about cosmic censorship in some vague language, or I'm assuming that if there are singularities that form in the bulk, if classical constitution is violated, that somehow at the quantum level, those singularities are resolved, and you can evolve the system through the singularities. These are common these are assumptions that many people believe will be true in the theory of quantum gravity. I also want to say, though, I'm explicitly assuming that in any quantum extension of the dynamics that allows one to evolve through the singularity, that this all happens in a context where the Hamiltonian, where there is still an object, I can call it Hamiltonian, which generates time evolution in this sense, and where that Hamiltonian is still built entirely out of these boundary observables, the boundary stress tensor and this Norman data for a scalar field. So at the quantum level, I'm making an assumption. Again, I'm going to justify this by saying that, well, it's true in the classical theory, so why shouldn't it be true in the quantum theory? I can also comment that if I look at quantum theories of gravity on the market, at least for two notable cases, this assumption appears to be true. In the context of string theory, say ABS, CFT, it's almost true by definition. In that context, the Hamiltonian is the integral of the boundary stress tensor, even at the quantum level. And from talking to my blue quantum gravity friends, they seem to believe that indeed any singularities in the bulk will be resolved by the quantum dynamics without changing the essential structure of the Hamiltonian, leaving it as a boundary term plus an integral of constraints, which is the form that I need for this. So that's my story about what kind of assumption I think I'm making here. Maybe I should pause and see if there are further comments before I go on, because this is the end of my discussion of what I want to call boundary unitarity, the equality of observable algebras at two times. And in a moment, I'm going to talk about this perturbative holography.
Can I ask, so we're doing some kind of boundary evolution, but do you know what that corresponds to in the bulk? I mean, the thing I'm confused about is that if I evolve according to the regular Schwarzschild time,
yes,
you know, I can do an evolution up and down the entire boundary, but I never all I evolve over, if my initial data slice is some simple slice, all I'm going to do is evolve and see the outside of the horizon.
Yeah.
So I'm never even going to see you with this this singularity that we're is going to be resolved.
I agree. That's good.
That's good.
Because dynamics mean, you know, time evolution in theory is pure games. I have nothing to say to that. I'm just talking about relating observables at two different times on the map. I mean, this is an important part of the story, is that in the discussion, black holes are kind of a side note or a tangential issue, but for the reasons Rob said, they're not really important.
Is that what you're saying?
Even in the interstate without black holes, information sticks on the boundary. Okay? As opposed to, we would normally try to describe information by looking at linearized fields of ADS as some exchange of information between the bulk and the boundary. And here I'm just pointing out that there is at least a sense where it remains on the boundary, whether or not there are black holes. But I agree with Rob that black holes are a complete side note in the story. I will come back to the other talk to say why I think this has something to say about black hole boundaries.
Okay. Okay.
Can I see if I can summarize your key points? So if I look, if I pick one set of components of T, okay, classically, I compute their Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian, which is some other components of T. It's a very complicated Poisson bracket that you don't know, and the result maps me into possibly some higher orders in your Pfefferman expansion.
Possibly.
So it's not true that the evolution of that the future of the T's is a function only of the present value of the T's, because it may involve some higher order. The Poisson brackets may throw you into some higher order information. But you are saying, don't worry about that, because the world is quantum mechanical, and quantum mechanically, that extra information is going to be obtainable by manipulating experiments on the boundary to construct those higher order things as commutators.
That is correct. That is the basic message.
That's the basic message.
Yep.
Can I follow up on that? So are you claiming that this exponentiation will fail classically or will work classically or neither?
So let me take the case of four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space with Einstein Hilbert gravity. In that context, I personally believe the cosmic censorship conjecture, and therefore I believe that this will succeed and not fail in the classical context.
Okay, so then I don't... Yeah, okay, so... Then I don't understand why it's not a contradiction to that example I was giving before. Because
to actually compute his exponentiation, he needs the value of the space-time metric on the whole bulk slice.
But he claims...
No, he doesn't, because the Poisson bracket requires extra information from arbitrarily high order. And as he exponentiates, he goes to arbitrarily high order in the Poisson bracket. Yeah. And arbitrarily high order in the Pfefferman expansion.
Is the question of a non-local. So are you saying that knowing the fields classically in the neighborhood of this boundary slice, including possibly even the bulk, as Lee was saying, but just the neighborhood of that, should be enough to compute the Poisson brackets or not? That's maybe the question.
Well, if you know it to all orders.
Know it fully, but in some finite neighborhood of that size. Would that be enough to compute the Poisson bracket?
When you say, Rocket, is your question if you know it for one particular solution or for all solutions?
So the point is, if there is a, there could be a modification of the initial data of compact support that doesn't show up to any order of the Pfefferman expansion, and right? There can be, if you construct solutions of the Einstein equations, and as you go to higher and higher order in your power series expansion in Z, you construct a certain class of solutions of the Einstein equations. And that class of solutions of the Einstein equation does not contain any solutions that have a slice such that there is a feature isolated of compact support, isolated from the boundary. So you do not get the whole space of solutions of Einstein equations.
But there's no meaning to having such a feature. It's just a relative statement between two different solutions.
Right.
Let me set this aside for a moment and move on. I think that what I want to talk about next addresses this point. So let me try. Okay. So let's move on to the next slide, slide 10. Oh, actually, let's skip this. Slide 10 isn't really relevant. Let's get slide 1. Okay. So I want to talk about a property that I call perturbative holography, which the intention of this, well, this addresses some of Raphael's question. Part of the question being asked here is, okay, I'm talking about some algebra boundary observables. We can take Poisson brackets and generate things that were not originally TIJs and phi, but they're new things. How much do we generate this way? Is this algebra observables complete in terms of the bulk theory truly, or is it just part of the information? Okay? And I would like to point out briefly that in fact, well, on the non-perturbative level, I'm not exactly sure, but the level of doing perturbation theory, even around interesting classical backgrounds, perhaps with collapsing black holes, as drawn in this Campola diagram, the answer is yes, this algebra of boundary observables is in fact complete. Okay? The argument here is not hard, so let's just go through this, and perhaps this will clarify this discussion with Raphael and Lee Ray. So let's take some interesting classical background. Say one where we have a collapsing black holes, there's a black hole in the future. For simplicity, I'm going to assume that there's no black hole in the past, that the space-time is largely empty. And in fact, a clean setup for this is to assume is make the boundary conditions slightly time-dependent so that we can have a basically empty space-time before t equals 0. Then we can wiggle the boundary a bit, maybe by putting in some non-trivial boundary conditions for the scalar field, having some radiation that comes in from the boundary and it collapses to make it black. Okay. So what I want to talk about perturbation theory. So let's start with the linearized equations of motion. Okay, that's of course the basis for all of perturbation theory. So imagine talking about the linearized gravitational field or the linearized scalar field equations of motion on this background. Okay. Then I guess I'm just going to make this as a claim, but it's true once we work out the details. At the linearized level, I could imagine any solution I like, maybe Raphael's native compact support. And if I evolve it back towards the past, then that data is just going to flow out towards the boundary and imprint itself on the boundary. And it's not hard to prove a little theorem that at the linearized level that if I give you both the Dirichlet and the Neumann data for a linearized field, everywhere on the boundary, not just at one time, but everywhere on the boundary, but this in fact determines the solution everywhere in the interior. In fact, the linearized level, if you work hard, you can actually write a kind of a Green's function expression that expresses the local field at any point in the bulk as an integral over its boundary values, Neumann and Dirichlet, within some sort of neighborhood at that point. This turned out to be by Stefan Hollands. This is related to a result in the theory of partial differential equations called Holmgren's uniqueness theorem, which states that, again, solutions that although giving data on a time-like surface is not freely specifiable initial data for a hyperbolic wave equation, it is nevertheless often the case that the solution to the differential equation is uniquely determined by specifying data on that time-like surface. So let me pause and see if that was clear, since I just made a kind of assertion. But again, the claim is that at the level of linearized fields, if you specify both the boundary conditions I've given, which is Dirichlet data, and you also specify the value of these boundary observables, the Neumann data, that will uniquely determine the solution everywhere in the interior. And as a result, that means that any bulk operator in the linearized theory can be written, at least in the gravitational case, up to gauge transformations, as a function of boundary observables at some set of times on the map.
I guess you mentioned linearized, but I guess if you were to step away to nonlinear, which you might do later on, you have all these very simple examples of, which I think T.D. Lee was making, you can make stars which keep pulsing around and never dissipate to infinity because it costs more energy to actually spread to the linear regime than they have. So with nonlinear things, there are explicit constructions where you can't leak away.
We can talk about this in the ADS context. Actually, my guess is that pulsating stars would imprint themselves on the boundary in the anti-de-Sitter context, just because ADS is like a finite box. It tends to know about things that are close by. At least if the star was made out of a scalar field or some kind of Lagrangian matter, I would think there'd be some leakage out of the boundary. But I completely agree that at the full nonlinear level, there could be, in principle, sort of true solitons which exist, which would give you some degeneracy here, which would have the same Dirichlet and Neumann data on the boundary, but with differing integers. And it's certainly true in the context of gravity. If you consider initial data containing a black hole and a black hole interior, it's quite straightforward to write such things down. That's why my statement about uniqueness here, or about completeness, is going to be a statement that holds only the level of perturbation theory. It's not going to hold more general. But it does hold the linearized level, and if it holds the linearized level, it holds essentially trivially at any order in perturbation theory, just because in perturbation theory, the interacting fields are nothing other than simple combinations of the linearized fields using Green's functions. So at the level of perturbation theory, there is again a kind of completeness result that if I allow myself all times on the boundary, the algebra of boundary observables is indeed.
You're not claiming, yes, of course, that the mapping from the boundary data to the bulk data is smooth or continuous or stable or something like that. I mean, there could be.
Oh, the truth is, at the linearized level, I think I have to make that claim. But if you want to push me on this, at the linearized level, I think it is smooth and fairly continuous. And well, let's see. It may depend on what you mean. It's certainly true that the boundary data is not freely specifiable. So I'm not going to claim that if you give me boundary data, I can make an arbitrary deformation of that and still have a smooth solution in the interior.
Because you have no solution.
You mean what? We still have no solution in the interior.
But if you have a solution, you think that it's...
What I do want to claim is that at the linearized level, as I say, it turns out you can write an explicit expression for, let's take the scalar case. At the linearized level of the scalar case, it turns out that one can write an explicit expression for the value of the scalar field at some point in the interior as a kind of integral over the boundary weighted by a certain Green's function. So, all right, that's my claim, that the relationship is, I don't know, smooth in that sense. There's a simple algebraic expression relating observables in the bulk, observables in the map.
Then an extra clarification to understand your statement. So you say there's a mapping, if I try to make it mathematical term, you say there's a mapping between the, you know, sets of Cauchy initial data, and then the sets of objects you have, or whatever boundary observables you have. And then you're claiming this mapping isn't good. That's what you're saying. So you have, it might be a very complicated mapping, but you're saying there's this mapping between data on the Cauchy slice and data on my timeline slice, which is an invertible,
yes,
mapping, at least in perturbation theory.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. It's an invertible on a certain domain. Again, I'm not claiming that I'm allowed to choose arbitrary data on the timeline slice, but if I stick to data that I know is allowed, then yes, there is a mapping that goes back to Cauchy.
At least it's injective. It's injective, so it's invertible on its image. So,
exactly.
Okay, so your main is then.
Exactly. All right. Clear. So this is the claim. So let's get to the next slide, Rob.
Lee had a quick question.
Before you go
yes,
ahead,
Lee?
Okay, if I have deep in the bulk a bar, which if it spun around would generate gravitational waves, but it's not spinning, okay, but I
yes,
fixed to the bar two rocket engines, okay, which will make it spin, attached to a little chip, which is running a very complicated program, which at some moment in time is going to turn the rocket engines on and make the thing spin. Do you claim
yes.
that the boundary data knows the program that's in that little chip that can therefore predict when that will start to generate gravitational waves?
So the claim I've made at the moment, okay, is that if you look at the boundary observables for all time, they will, from
well, sure, because eventually they receive the gravitational radiation, so they can
exactly.
retrodict.
Exactly.
But at one time.
So far the claims about the algebraic boundary observables at all times, as you say, they will receive that gravitational radiation and use that information to compute back when your chip fired.
Right.
That's the claim so far. We will move further on slide 12.
Okay,
so let's go to slide 12.
I should say that we've hit 25 after, so I'm hoping to wrap up in 5 minutes.
I hope so too. All right, slide 12 is the end of this discussion, and then we'll move on to some, let's see what we can do. So let's try to finish slide 12 here. So far, we have the statement at the top, that the algebra of all perturbative observables is equal to the algebra of boundary observables. Well, I said at all times, let's say at all times. Let's not even worry about the t less than zero. So the algebra for all perturbative observables is equal to the algebra of boundary observables at all times. Great. There's nothing holographic about that. That's just solving linearized equations. That's this Holmgren's uniqueness theorem or something. Okay. What's interesting, though, is that in the gravitational context, I want to borrow my argument of what I call boundary unitarity, which I previously applied in a non-determinative context, and I want to apply it in this context of perturbation theory. And I can do that because as long as I'm not in a linearized theory, as long as I'm in any interacting order in the gravitational perturbation theory, it is once again true that the gravitational Gauss's law at infinity knows about all the energy inside. That is to say, it is once again true in any finite order in perturbation theory that I can write the Hamiltonian for the system on shell as a pure boundary term. So rather than repeat anything, I will just make the observation that in perturbation theory, the gravitational Hamiltonian is a boundary term, borrow my argument for boundary unitarity, and apply it to the right-hand side of my equality here. I will use it to reformulate the algebra of boundary observables at all times in terms of the algebra of boundary observables at one single time. Putting this all together, then, I've now claimed that the algebra of all perturbative observables everywhere in the bulk is equal to the algebra of boundary observables at any one single time. And that's a claim that I think deserves the name perturbative holography. It is now the claim that at least at the quantum level, by measuring sort of repeated commutators of things at the boundary near some one constant time surface, I can recover the information that would have been associated with any perturbative observable in the world. So that's the main claim for this part of the talk.
Don't get into
all right.
Just a small comment then. If I understand right, what you're saying is you would like a properly quantized theory with diffeomorphism invariance to have this property, though proving that might involve things which you are not doing here. For example, some properties like when you finally get the theory, the boundary will really know about the bulk and so on. So in some sense, you're pushing the problem to parts which you're not doing, but that's what you hope the proper theory would do and should do. Is that the statement?
You may say that. I would phrase it a little bit more generously by also reminding you that I'm claiming that at the level of statements of observable algebras, this I'm claiming is a true statement for classical GR. Okay. So yes, indeed, I am making hypotheses about an unknown, not perturbative quantum theory that I don't understand and cannot present for you in detail. But I'm pointing out that there is a mechanism in classical gravity already, which is just gravitational constraints and gauge invariance, Diffeo invariance, which seems to lead to this property. So I think it's entirely natural for any quantum theory to have the same consequence for the same reason, something that is basically bulk gravitational constraints and something like Diffeo.
Okay, now, all right, now Don, now I'm going to make my little computer in the chip, the Turing machine.
Yes.
Okay, you probably knew this was coming. And it's going to fire the rocket engines if it stops. Okay, now you claim that your algebra of boundary observables at a single time is able to solve the problem that Turing's theorem says is unsolvable, which is predict whether or not that Turing machine is going to stop and hence generate gravitational radiation.
this is not a contradiction. I mean, let's just remind ourselves. Turing's theorem says that this problem is unsolvable sort of in general, that you can't write a code that will tell you in a finite time whether it...
I think you're saying if you can't look at the machine, then you can't look at the boundary. If you can see it from looking at the machine,
yes,
then you can see it.
All this going on here is solving the equations of motion. So there's nothing that's more sophisticated here. It just says that, I mean, put it this way. The boundary observables won't actually answer Lee's question, okay? It won't tell you in general whether or not gravitational waves exist Lee wants to know whether gravitational waves are ever emitted by this device. What this theory tells you how to do is to do a calculation that's sort of the equivalent of, I look at an hour later and find out if gravitational waves have been emitted. Then I look at 2 hours later and see if gravitational waves have been emitted. Then I look at 3 hours later. And I can imagine putting these all together at an infinite amount of tests of the boundary thermal algebra to see if gravitational waves are ever emitted. But that's not a contradiction in Turing's. That's allowed. We're allowed to run the program for an hour, see if it stops, run it for 2 hours, see if it stops, etc. Okay, so I don't think the issues of computational complexity are relevant to this discussion.
Okay,
all right.
Let's take it more slowly.
Out of time, I would like to make a brief comment about black hole evaporation. So if we could advance through the slides to slide, let me try to do this for just one, let's see, slide 14. Maybe if it was just one slide, slide 15, okay? So let me just give you the picture of what I think happens in black hole evaporation, right? So if you're on slide 15, there's again a picture of an evaporating black hole on the left. And I had tried to argue, oh, I guess I should have summarized the asymptotically flat story. Oh, well, I tried to argue in the asymptotically anti-de-Sitter case that there's something called perturbative holography, that the information which is encoded in perturbative observables is in fact encoded also in the asymptotic fields at any one time. So if I had time to tell you my story of asymptotically flat space, I would reach a similar conclusion about fields near space-like infinity. And I would claim that information which is carried into the black hole by information which you normally describe as being carried into the black hole by incoming matter is also encoded in these asymptotic fields near space-like infinity, the most important of which is again the ADM Hamiltonian, nicely marked on that diagram. So then I just want to remind you that in the context of a backward-looking black hole, I could study these gravitational constraints that I like so much perturbatively. And what they would tell me is basically Gauss's law that this equation on the right over there, that the ADM Hamiltonian is related to the integral of the linearized stress energy over some hypersurface, say the surface sigma that I've drawn, which connects space-like infinity to the evaporating black hole horizon. There's a relationship between ADM Hamiltonian and this stress energy of basically the Hawking radiation. As long as I take care to include a second boundary term at the horizon, that I call phi sub h, the Gauss's law of flux there at the horizon. So then the argument is that in some sense, I claim that the information that we think of as going into the black hole is also encoded basically in this ADM Hamiltonian operator. But then we have the gravitational constraints that give us an operator equality between the ADM Hamiltonian, this Gauss law flux at the boundary at the black hole horizon, and an integral over the Hawking radiation stress space. And we certainly expect that as the black hole evaporates, this boundary term at the black hole horizon goes to zero. It's basically just the mass left in the black hole. So if the evaporation proceeds and is complete and that phi h operator becomes zero, the gravitational constraints would, in that context, directly relate the ADM Hamiltonian to what's basically the Hawking radiation. And so I might propose this just the gravitational constraints and local energy conservation as a mechanism to transfer the information into outgoing quantum radiation. All right, I will stop here because my time is definitely out. I don't know if Rob will let me field any more questions, but thank you for your attention.
I'm not going to keep anyone here. There's lunch upstairs, but people who are interested should certainly feel free to ask questions.
All right. So I will pause and let folks disperse for lunch if they like, but I promise to remain here for a few minutes if someone wishes to remain behind and ask more questions.
Good question about the math case. You mentioned
yes.
this inequality of U is less than U naught that was sufficient. At least in the beginning of this talk. Could you elaborate on that? The U naught part? Because it seems, why wouldn't one need stuff later than U naught?
So you might also ask, why don't you need the information that would appear to flow through the black hole horizon? And those questions have the same answer. Okay? Basically, let's see. So I have to go through the details of the argument here, but the structure is somewhat like my anti-Sitter argument, where I imagine using the Hamiltonian to translate operators around on the space line. So what
U-Nov is on the future, it's on Sprite Plus?
Yes. Yes, U-Nov is on Sprite Plus, yes. So the statement is that in the asymptotically flat case, a complete set of observables can be found at space-like infinity and on a, if you like, arbitrarily short piece of Sprite Plus just to the future of space-like infinity. Okay. So I take it, and the way this argument works is I sort of take as given that a complete set of observables can be formulated on all of Sprite minus, all of past infinity.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then I argue that you can, at least in a certain approximation, you can map every operator down here on Sprite minus into this tiny region of Sprite plus, together with, by using the ABM Hamiltonian living at
Geisel. Okay.
And in two words, the way that works is you take an operator at a finite place on Sprite minus, you use the ABM Hamiltonian to push it deep down in the past, close to past time-like infinity, and then you use the perturbative gradients of motion to propagate it through the bulk. You bounce it off the interior long before the black hole forms, and it comes out at an early time on Sprite Plus. That's the basic structure of the argument. There are many technicalities we can talk about, or I can refer you to it.
So, Don, this last transparency went by very quickly, but
indeed,
if I continued your surface sigma across to R, you know, where the interior there, then I wouldn't have had a surface term, and you would have said the information is spread out, or that a Hamiltonian has this in, or it's the information's not shared. There's information on the part outside. There's information on the part inside. So essentially, here you're saying though that on that. On any slice through the interior there, I can put all that, or I can see all that information in the boundary term by H. Isn't that the case?
Yes.
So even,
yes, I agree.
So somehow the information, because of the diffeomorphisms invariants, all of that interior stuff is, or for just that finite little bit of the space, is sort of encoded in a boundary term there on the horizon.
That's right.
Is there anything special about the horizon? I mean, could I have picked any other point? Or
let's pick any other point.
Okay.
Again, the black holes are in a certain sense the side note here. The issue is more general information in gravitational physics and the gravitational constraints.
What does it mean to pick any other point? That's not a different one.
Yeah, you cannot do a definition in a different way.
I agree. So if you find the Diffie-Hilbert specification of another point, you can pick it. So I should say here that we're touching on an interesting set of issues. I've made what I hope is a certain set of precise claims which are in contexts that require certain boundary conditions. And I've chosen these boundary conditions because I can make clean claims there. There are real observables I can talk about, and I can talk about relations between observable algebras. I certainly expect that there are messages of this general flavor in other contexts as well, with, say, cosmological boundary conditions, or where there are no boundaries and so forth. But I certainly do not know how to make any clean statements in those contexts, precisely for the sort of reasons that Laurent and Raphael have said here, which is that I don't know how to, I don't have a good way of picking out diffeomorphism and invariant concepts in those contexts, or talking about observables. So I think it's very suggestive of important properties of gravitational physics more generally, but it seems like a difficult research program to make precise statements in other contexts.
Let me ask one other question about the classical case, which is probably simpler. So you've couched everything in terms of algebras and observables.
Yes.
But when you talk about exponentiating the Hamiltonian, you have in mind really some sort of phase space and a symplectic structure, I guess. That's part of the question. So do you have in mind that there's effectively living in infinity some sort of phase space? And can you say anything about what that phase space looks like?
You know, I mean, my thinking about this is in terms of the usual bulk phase space. I just want to think about the usual Clairvoyant phase space you would define for a gravitational system. And then I want to talk about that particular maybe it's a sub-algebra, maybe it's not, maybe it's the full algebra, but the algebra of observables on the bulk phase space defined by these asymptotic fields. So maybe it's useful to think about a concept of a phase space that lives just at infinity, but I couldn't say that.
Would you agree that, I mean, technically, here you draw some lines of sort of that. For me, technically, what's missing is a concrete realization of the Poisson bracket and the phase space at infinity that allows to, you know, kind of start to work with it. You agree with that? It's not like it's a side question, it's maybe a technical question, but you want to have your hands on what is exactly this bracket.
So if your goal is to use this to actually, you know, quantize gravity algebraically, then you need that kind of information you've been asking for. You need an explicit presentation of the algebra. I don't give that. That's not my goal here. My goal is to kind of understand the way that information propagates or works in gravitational physics. And for that, I think the statements I've made are sufficient. I don't need an explicit presentation of the algebra.
So there's still a paradox here, which is that if you actually compute the Hawking radiation, it's thermal. So is there a way for you to say what the error is in that computation?
Yes, I think so. Okay. So let's focus on this relation I've written on the screen here. HEVM minus phi H is basically the interval of the stresses. Okay? So this is an equation which is true in semi-classical gravity. Okay, so you might say, your question is really, if I'm claiming that this equation transfers information to the Hawking radiation, what is the Hawking calculation C? Okay, what's the error? So the issue is that we certainly expect that this boundary term phi h goes to zero as the black hole evaporates, but if I try to use that to ask, at the level of perturbation theory in the semi-classical context, how fast is information transferred into the Hawking radiation? Okay. Well, it's not so clear. It depends on how much information can be stored in the phi h operator, right? And this is really a question now about states or the density of states of the phi h operator. What's the spectrum of phi h? How closely packed is it? How many states are there with new general eigenvalues? And I haven't done this calculation in detail, but I think it's clear what the answer is. Again, this phi h is basically the mass operator for the local black hole in some rough language. And we know that in perturbation theory, or in semi-classical physics, if you study the fluctuations near the black hole horizon, there's a continuum of states. There's an infrared divergence because of the horizon. So I would certainly expect that the level of semi-classical physics, this phi h has a continuous spectrum, and therefore an infinite density of states. So at the semi-classical level, it is therefore perfectly consistent to have this equation be true, but so to speak, no information transferred to the Hawking radiation somehow until the last possible moment. Okay. That's not the situation that we expect to find in non-perturbative theory. So what I would argue is the crucial input to seeing the information transferred at a finite rate into the Hawking radiation, in addition to what I talked about here, is some input about the non-perturbative density of states. What really is the density of states that phi h on? So to summarize, I have not explained exactly how fast the information is transferred to Hawking radiation in this story. But I think I have provided some useful comments on what's usually considered the paradoxical part. That is to say, one usually says, okay, no matter what happens in non-perturbative theory, how could information possibly be transferred to TAV without some acausal, non-local kind of physics? And here I find at least a mechanism. Where I'm claiming the only kind of non-locality that you need is the kind of non-locality that's embodied in the gravitational constraints. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, with that, I think we should cut things off and get up to lunch. So let's thank John and all of the listeners. And we're supposed to resume here at 2:30. So we have 40 minutes for lunch. Thank you, Don.